Hi, this is Scott. I really appreciate our sponsors because they make the show possible. Today's show is sponsored by Developer Express. Become a UI superhero with DevExpress, controls, and libraries. Deliver elegant .NET solutions that address customer needs today by leveraging your existing knowledge. You can build next-generation touch-enabled solutions for tomorrow. You can download your free 30-day trial at dx.hanselminutes.com. That's dx.hanselminutes.com.
From HanselMinutes.com, it's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 558. In this episode, Scott talks with Dr. Henry Segerman about visualizing mathematics with 3D printing.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes. Today I'm talking with Dr. Henry Segerman. He works at the Department of Mathematics at Oklahoma State, and he has a great website called 3D Print Math, where you can learn about his book, Visualizing Mathematics with 3D Printing. How are you, sir?
Doing pretty well, thanks. Yeah. So the website is, it's sort of a sister to the book, right? It's maybe not so much an ad as it's like the book really uses like 3D models, and you want to be able to see those models virtually, at least on the website. So you want to really use the two together.
No, absolutely. I mean, and this book is a book that you would use in class, but I also kind of, as a 3D printer fan myself, this is almost like the coffee table book for 3D printers in math.
Yeah. I mean, right. So I haven't actually talked with it yet. I view it more like a popular math book that, people who are interested, maybe know a little bit of math, but you shouldn't need much in terms of background. And it isn't really a textbook. It's sort of, conversational, and here are some cool ideas and use these 3D printed models to show, what's going on. And yeah, it doesn't go into, there's not a lot of technical notation, but there's some interesting ideas and some things you might have to think about, but.
Is this a practice? Did this get discovered? I mean, like the 3D printing is burgeoning and math certainly is not.
Right. It's not starting up. So there's something of a reputation or an unwarranted reputation that mathematics is sort of written in stone. And what happens is it gets passed down to, students. And, what is it that professional mathematicians do anyway? They're just doing more hard sums. And that's really not the case. I mean, there's new mathematics getting invented all the time. And that's what mathematicians do. There's new stuff happening all the time and new ways of thinking and about mathematics. And it's often useful to have a 3D print, for example, something to visualize some idea. So 3D printing has been around at least since the 80s. It was originally, used in manufacturing, or design. And I guess only in the last few years has it got accessible to people in the general public and academics and so on. That combination of, take something, that's mathematical and try and produce a model of it. That's got a lot easier now that there's 3D printing than it was before. Around the turn of the previous century, so 1900, there were a bunch of people who were sort of getting into making plaster models and models out of string and wood and so on. And those are still around, but it's a lot harder to do, if you have to sort of make it from scratch. Whereas if you've got a 3D printer, then it's a lot more accessible.
Interesting. So you're saying that if I go back to the early days, if I go 100 years back, I'll be doing my math on a chalkboard, on paper, in pairs, in groups, and they were themselves building models so that they might get their heads around things?
There's another sort of interesting thing throughout mathematical history is sort of whether or not you want to draw pictures and make models has gone in and out of fashion. So, So there were people back in the day making plaster models of algebraic surfaces, who knows what. And beautiful, fantastic craftsmanship. And I mean, given the technology at the time, difficult to do. And then there was a long dark period when, people decided, well, you know, pictures are sort of squirrely, right? You can think that you're seeing something when actually, you know, it's not really rigorous. The argument doesn't quite follow, that you're not drawing all of the different cases. And so there was a long period when, sort of pictures and diagrams were frowned upon. And maybe this is sort of, in the modern era, you know, people are saying, well, you know, there's different ways to do things and you want to find different ways to communicate, say mathematics, different ways of communicating work for different people. And so for some people, the pictures are really, you know, really helpful. And so, yeah, it's come back in and out of fashion. And I guess at the moment, there's a lot of, you know, emphasis on how do you get people into STEM subjects. And so people are sort of, well, whatever goes, right? I mean, if you can find something that interests people, then go for it.
Interesting. So it almost is a matter of how do different people think. There are probably math people who are, for lack of a better word, a little more snooty, that are like, well, we don't need to visualize this, right? surely you can hold that, you know, that three manifold in your brain.
There's plenty of mathematics that doesn't require pictures at all. I mean, mathematics is a very broad endeavor. And, you know, there's some things we agree on, right? You should always need to prove things, any of your statements. But the kinds of objects that people think about, you know, vary hugely. This is another sort of unusual thing about mathematics as a subject is, you know, I don't really know what the guy in the next door office does, right? It's sort of too far away from what I do for me to really be, I know the broad outlines, but very, very broad. And so, yeah, I mean, there's somebody down the hall who never draws any pictures at all. Whereas I'm drawing pictures all the time. And a lot of the proofs that I write are in terms of pictures. You have some sort of, combinatorial diagram and you say, well, you know, if I do this kind of move, then this thing happens, right? It's the argument is in pictures. And for a lot of people, no pictures at all, ever.
Yeah. Was the first person who really got excited about visualizing things physically, was it Felix Klein in the late 1800s?
I would go back to the prehistoric era. I mean, it's sort of hard to say, right? Well, so the ancient Greeks were very into, you know, geometry. I mean, that was sort of the first, you know, that the Euclidean geometry was maybe the really first instance of what we'd think of as rigorous mathematics, where you actually prove things rather than, you know, just sort of, yeah, there's plenty of mathematics in Babylonian times and so on, where you need to calculate, you know, areas of land or taxes or whatever it is, but they weren't proving things back then. But yeah, so the Greeks, 2000 BC, maybe, don't quote me on that, were drawing pictures. And it goes back even further than that. So there were, sort of Neolithic carvings on stone that appear to be, you know, there's a stone which is sort of carved in with nodules and it looks like it's a cube or maybe a dodecahedron. There's some debate over exactly what was going on. And of course, we don't have any history of that, but people were, you know, saying, here's this pattern of dots on a sphere, which sort of looks like a cube, back in, you know, before any written history was there at all.
When Klein in Germany went and, you know, drew and created these plaster molds, then they started to manufacture them and give them. And like, it seems like you could go to all the work of doing this yourself, but that would be a lot of effort.
Right. Well, I mean, and it's amazing, you know, the craftsmanship of how they did it. So you're building some shape of some surface out of plaster. As I understand it, what they did is they did it in slices. So they would, you know, very carefully plot out, you know, here's the slice at a particular height, and they would have to figure out what the contour line was and, you know, cut that out or whatever it is they had to do and then stack them up and then somehow smooth it down. But yeah, very, very hard work. These days, of course, with 3D printing, it's a lot easier. There's all kinds of programs or you can write your own programs to generate the geometry and then get it 3D printed. And yeah, much, much easier.
Yeah, that was my kind of my sub question there, was looking at this and thinking about there's no computers, there's minimal mechanical help, is there not, to get it right?
Right. Well, back in 1900 some in or so, yeah. I mean, right. Well, the modern computer certainly didn't exist back then. Yeah. So it was all sort of hand calculation, and they came out with these amazing things.
Yeah. I mean, I'm trying to put this in the context of someone who is, you know, who did college math and then stopped. Mm-hmm. Right. You know, and I understand how tedious it would be to, you know, take a parabola and plot it out, you know, in some detail in just two dimensions.
Right.
And then you add two or three and then.
Yeah. You have to stack them up. Well, I mean, somehow this is just more generally true, right? That people spend a long time doing things that now we wouldn't want to wait, you know, half an hour.
Patience. Right? Patience existed in the old days.
There's all these stories of people calculating, you know, the nth digit of pi or something. And, or, you know, one of these, you know, just calculate out this thing that today you can run in, you know, seconds on a computer. And, you know, somewhere in year three, they made a mistake and all the digits afterwards are wrong. You know, I mean, it's just,
that's so sad.
I guess, you know, I mean, looking back, right, it was a slower time. And the same with math research and just the flow of ideas. You know, back then, the way that things happened was that, you know, people would send letters to each other via snail mail, and maybe they'd wait for, you know, a publication to come out in a journal. And, you know, if the journal was, well, this is still sort of true. If the journal is in Russian, then, you know, it doesn't make it over to the English speaking world or the French speaking world for another 20 years or so. And now, you know, so there's electronic archives where people figure something out and they post it on the archive, and, you know, the email gets sent out to everybody who's following that subject, and people know about it, you know, the next day. So yeah, things are much, much faster. Than it used to be.
So has the world of visualizing mathematics with 3D printing exploded with the idea that I can go to Home Depot and buy a 3D printer?
I don't know if it's exploded is true. I mean, 3D printing, as you know, is getting to be more and more mainstream. I mean, the combination of the two, I don't know, there's a few people, sort of doing this and figuring out how to, you know, how do I teach a class using 3D prints? How do I teach a math class? I think there's, you know, a lot of, intersections between, well, any new technology and, an academic subject. There's going to be, well, how can I use it to do this? I mean, I've also started thinking about using virtual reality or augmented reality for this kind of thing. And, you know, it's sort of, well, whatever, what is a good way to use this technology to do something that couldn't be done before or to reach other people?
The question underneath that is when you're hanging out wherever mathematicians hang out,
right,
you know, in the mathematician, you know, kitchen.
At a conference, whatever.
Yeah. And you're going on about how you just built something with a 3D printer and how it helped you understand it or it helped a class understand it.
Sure.
Do the other mathematicians look at you like, ah, you know, that Henry?
You get both, right? And it depends. A lot of people are really excited and, you know, want to get hold of a model of something that I've made, or quite a few of the things I've made come out of conversation where somebody is like, you know, so at the start of all of my talks, I spend 10 minutes explaining this thing. If only I had a model, then I could just sort of show people, and then they tell me what the thing is and we try and work out how to make a model. So some people are really enthusiastic, and, you know, particularly, I guess, people who think in pictures. There is some resistance, and there's just, this is sort of a more general thing. Mm-hmm. There's some resistance to, communicating with the outside world in a sense. Right? I mean, there were some mathematicians who were like, well, you know, if you didn't make it, if you're not at least a graduate student, then you're never going to understand what I do. So there's not really any point in talking to you.
Oh my.
I may be
but
exaggerating
it's
a little.
Yeah, but
well,
it's pretty.
Yeah. But I mean, there's a lot of mathematics which I mean, I'm lucky, right? In a sense, the area that I've gone into, lends itself to an illustration which can be appreciated by members of the general public. Mm-hmm. And there's lots of very beautiful, you know, meaningful and difficult mathematics, which you can't see unless you've spent, you know, at least a couple of years in graduate school to understand what the objects are that we're talking about. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's not necessarily a royal road to the mathematics that you're interested in. In some cases there is, and you can get a sense of things. And in some cases that just isn't true. Which isn't to say that the stuff that people are doing isn't useful. I mean, you can't really tell, or, you know, good, right? You can't tell what's going to be useful down the line. And there's this whole other debate of, are we doing mathematics because it's useful to society, or are we doing mathematics because for its own sake, you know, as a sort of art form in a way? But yeah, I mean, if you want to go the useful route, then, it's impossible to tell what's going to be useful 100 years down the line. This is exactly what people need in order to solve whatever problem they're trying to solve.
Yeah. Well, thinking about it, there's the artistic, you know, benefits of it. There's the practical applications of it.
Right.
But, you know, just using one of your videos as an example, and I would encourage people to go and check out your YouTube channel.
Yeah.
You have one that's called Tetrahedral Racks.
Tetrahedral
racks, right. And it looks like, you know, it's almost like a kind of gear on three different axes, but it moves in a way that this is what got my attention.
Cool. Yeah. So I mean, maybe just to describe,
please,
what's going on for people who haven't seen the video. So it's a 3D printed mechanism, and there's these four different kind of rod pieces that slide into each other. Well, actually, each of these rods has sort of three different sticks on it, and they've got teeth like gear teeth. So rack is like a rack and pinion mechanism is where you have sort of an ordinary gear, like a circular gear. Mm-hmm. Then it's the teeth are pushing a straight, beam, which has teeth in it as well. So you can move this changes between sort of rotational and, translational movement. Anyway, so that's racks. That's what the term means. And so there's these four of these, and they're arranged in the symmetries of a tetrahedron, so tetrahedral racks, and all four of them somehow move through each other in this sort of complicated way. So this is maybe closer to art than mathematics, or perhaps engineering, right? I mean, there was sort of an engineering challenge. Can you make geared things that move in this way and can only move in this way. But yeah, it produces this surprising motion. I mean, I guess, I don't know if the question is this useful for anything? Or
well,
is it,
I guess
is it
what
just
I'm saying is that when I look at that, or there's another video you have on number file called Three Gears Are Possible, where, you know, one might say this doesn't look practical, but it is a kind of three-dimensional constrained gear that might very well be possible, or be useful, rather.
Right.
So, well, someone might be looking at that from a, you know, manufacturing perspective and saying, that's exactly what I needed. I didn't even know that was possible.
It's possible. I mean, you know, I'd be skeptical because, you know, both of these mechanisms and other things I've done, you know, I'm not worrying about it, you know, efficiently transferring force.
No, of course.
And, you know, so if you want something to be actually part of a motor, there's all kinds of other things that you need to worry about. So I'm sort of more interested in just like, what are the possibilities? But yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, these could, if not this mechanism, then be an inspiration for somebody else to say, oh, wait, maybe I can modify what I'm working on using this idea or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, just a sort of broader point there. You know, what is math good for? You don't necessarily model the real world very well, right? You model sort of aspects of it. I mean, this is one of the ways in which you can sort of see that math started is you've got the real world is complicated and messy, and you take some aspect of it and you say, okay, if I throw all of the stuff, all of the other stuff away, then I can actually say something. I can actually prove something.
Right.
And then maybe that is useful or maybe it isn't. And then you sort of get interested in the, you know, the questions and the the setting in its own right, and then maybe it comes back into contact with the real world later, or maybe not. That's also cool.
What, the other thing that is I'm finding fascinating, and again, please do forgive my my lack of proper math, but there's a the dimension, the addition of other dimensions, the dimensionality of this has been amazing. So, starting with the racks or the gears, where the extra dimension is time, you're seeing and experiencing something that's three-dimensional, moving through time. You can move it with your own body. So as a learner, it's very kinesthetic, you know?
Right.
It reinforces what you already know or what you think you already know. So that the addition of time seems really powerful. But then you also have a whole series on four-dimensional space things, where something looks cool, and then you look at it as a shadow, and then it looks impossibly cool.
just on the sort of point of kinesthetics, I think there's a really good point there. And like, you know, well, what is 3D printing good for? As you know, if you're looking around and saying, what can I do with this thing that I can't do in some other medium? Then the you're able to touch it. You're able to, you know, see it in your full stereo vision in real life. The bandwidth of reality is really good. So you can't get quite that sort of level of fidelity with, you know, a fancy computer animation or something. So I like 3D printed things that, you know, you can, that move, and you can move with your own hands so that you're not just watching a movie of something. Mm-hmm. And also, you know, there's some interaction with the real world. So you mentioned these shadow things. There's two different levels here. So there's casting shadows of three-dimensional things onto the two-dimensional table, with an actual physical light, right? So this sort of goes into the 3D printing is an object in the real world, and you understand bits of plastic, and you understand, you know, a flashlight. And so, you know, it's real in the way that a computer animation of some shadows is less real somehow. That's one point, that, you know, casting shadows from 3D to 2D. And then, as you say, the sort of, the next level up is casting shadows of four-dimensional things into three dimensions, which, you know, we don't have, as far as we know, physical four-dimensional things, but we can imagine, what they would be like, and we can calculate what their shadows would be like. So shadows, take you from a something dimensional thing to a something minus one dimensional thing. So if you have a four dimensional object, you can cast a shadow down onto the table, which is a three dimensional slice through four dimensional space. And then, then it's in three dimensions. So I can print it. So I guess this is another direction that mathematicians, or some mathematicians, go is try and figure out what's going on in other contexts, right? I understand two-dimensional geometry. I understand three-dimensional geometry. Well, what happens if I try doing it with four? And one of the ways to try and see what's going on is this sort of casting shadows. And there's a few other tricks. It's sort of difficult because we're really not, we did not evolve in a world which had any four-dimensional things in it. So, our visualization skills need a lot of help to try and, you know, get some sort of sense of what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever made something or printed something where you didn't fully understand what you were going to get until you got the LED and projected and waited?
This is the flashlight shadow thing. I mean, so this one, those ones, usually what happens is I know what the shadow is going to be first. And then I make the 3D object that's going to cast that shadow as a result, right? So I already know what I want to draw. But the sort of broader question was, I guess there's two levels of that question. One, when I finally get the 3D print in my hand, do I notice something new? And two, there's this sort of step of, I mean, even when it appears on my computer screen and I've drawn this thing in three dimensions, do I see something new? And both of those can happen. Yeah. So I mostly use Shapeways, so that the selective laser sintering, fancy stuff, rather than the kind of desktop
filament. Oh, really? So you prefer to order your 3D prints when you're ready to?
I mean, I sort of started out that way. I was sort of cheaper to start up. And, you know, the quality's really nice of the, you know, sintered plastic. You don't really see the layers so much. And it kind of has, yeah, I mean, it's a really nice aesthetic. The downside is you can't sort of iterate very quickly because, you know, it takes a week for them to send you something. But yeah, I mean, the Shapeway stuff is really nice. And it sort of has this sort of, is this white plastic that sort of, it's matte. And you don't really see how it was made, and it has this sort of almost, kind of almost otherworldly in some ways, right? It doesn't look like it looks like it's sort of just made out of primordial substance, right? I mean, it doesn't look like it. It just looks like geometry. And for displaying the mathematics, that's sort of what you want. You just want it to be.
Yeah. That's a really good point. You wouldn't want the 3D printing and inexpensive desktop 3D printers have that textured look where it's clear each layer has been put there, and it would take away from the geometry.
I mean, sometimes you do want that, right? If you're saying, look, here are the contours of this shape, and you can see how the contours on a geographical map. And so the printer gives you that for free, but you don't always want that. But one time this, do I notice something new when I get the 3D print? So there was one, it's called Hilbert Cube, I think, or Hilbert Curve, something like that. This is a very squiggly, curve that kind of fills up a cube in space. And this is, there's this whole, area of, mathematics that's interested in space filling curves, which is somehow curves that are so squiggly that they hit every point. So it's a one-dimensional curve somehow, but it hits every point of a two-dimensional square or a three-dimensional cube. So there's some sort of strange things going on there. But anyway, it wasn't hitting every point, this 3D print. It was just sort of an approximation of it, which is this, it looks a bit like ramen noodles. and I sort of, you know, I'd known it, I knew of this shape for a long time. And it was always this sort of rigid mathematical thing with lots of right angles. And then I get it and it's all springy because it's like ramen noodles. And I guess I hadn't realized that it was going to be like that. It was a big shock.
it was hard in your mind. It didn't flex.
Right. In my mind is this rigid mathematical object. And then the real world, it's got all of these engineering problems. And then, that's a whole other story. You end up with, when you want to make a model, your mathematical object doesn't need to deal with gravity and, you know, technical problems of actually printing things. And then, so there's a whole lot of sort of engineering problems that sometimes go into this, which leads to interesting questions. Yeah.
It does. So one of my questions is, how many of these will I be able to print versus with my desktop?
Oh, yeah.
Versus which we just won't be supportable.
Right. So, I mean, some of them are just not going to be possible on today's desktop printers. I mean, there's the sort of things with hinges. So you can do hinges on desktop printers, but I've got models with, you know, hundreds of hinges, sort of flexible surface, that I think would be very difficult to do on a desktop printer. But I've been surprised. I mean, you know, when I was writing the book, I was sort of thinking in my mind, in the back of my mind, well, hopefully people, actually, I was hoping by the time I'm done with this book, surely the technology will have moved on so far that everybody will be able to print everything at no cost. And that hasn't happened, but maybe in the future. But there's a surprising number of them that people are having a lot of success with. So, I mean, almost all of the models are on Thingiverse. And, you know, somehow that's the point is you put the stuff up and then people print it and show, look, I made it. Here's a photograph and here are the settings that I used. Or sometimes people get back to me and say, you know, could you make the base a bit thicker so that it sticks to my build plate better? And I say, oh, okay, I can do that. And sometimes people, you know, modify them themselves. And that's a really great thing about a site like Thingiverse is that, you know, it's sort of built in to let people share the things and modify them and get them working on their printers. So some, not all of them, but quite a few of them, seem to work well, and, you know, lots of people are printing them.
I'm working on printing the, you've got one that is a stereographic projection of a grid.
Yeah, the sort of, it's a sort of sphere with the top missing and, and this grid. Yeah, a lot of people seem to have done that. And I was surprised.
It's like a little vase that you put in a light. And what's interesting about it is that it's almost like a puzzle in the sense of it just looks like a pretty vase. And then you move the light around and nothing particularly interesting happens. It casts some nice shadows. And then there's a moment when if you get the shadow right.
Right.
It turns into a grid, and it's just impossible.
Regular square grid. Yeah, it's a surprising. Yeah, it's got a good payoff, that one. It's sort of like it's as you say, it's a magic trick, but it's real because it's a piece of plastic and a flashlight, right? There's, you know, we know how these things work. So, and this is and this is illustrating stereographic projection is a particular way to map a sphere onto the plane. In fact, this is, so I think the ancient Greeks knew about this. It's sort of in the same class of things like the Mercator projection, right? So the, you know, the ordinary map of the Earth, it's sort of out of favor these days because Africa appears much smaller than relative to Greenland so things near the equator seem smaller than they are in comparison to, things away from the equator. So there's sort of social reasons, not to really favor that map anymore. But anyway, that aside, so the Mercator projection, all these other, ways of drawing maps are ways to try and solve the problem of drawing the surface of a sphere on the plane. And, you know, this is impossible to do without breaking something, right? You know, if you get your orange peel and you try and lay it flat on the table, then it has to crack. So stereographic projection was, I think, maybe the first or one of the first ways that people thought to draw a picture of the Earth on the plane. And so it's in that tradition, of sort of map making, but it's a really beautiful way to map things. It's got a lot of very nice properties. It's very simple to write down. And yeah, I mean, this is sort of, a really great way to see it. And to see what the map is doing, because you just follow the light rays and you can do it. The next thing is, well, can you take a 3D printed, you know, sphere, with the Earth and the continents and somehow put a light inside of it so that somewhere you get a shadow that's the Mercator projection? And unfortunately, that appears to be impossible. I wish it were possible. I don't know how to do it.
That would be amazing.
That would be pretty classy, yeah.
Yeah, that would be classy. So people can go to 3dprintmath.com. They can click buy now at the top and they can see your book, Visualizing Mathematics with 3D Printing. They can go to Shapeways. And if they just Google for Henry Segerman 3D Printing, you have a beautiful website at Shapeways. And even if you don't have a 3D printer, you can go and order some of these and experience this magic yourself.
Or, at the website, there's also there's embedded sort of 3D viewers from Sketchfab. So you don't even need the 3D prints if you want to. Well, I mean, you can look at the photos in the book, but you can't turn them around. Sort of, there's an irony there in writing a book about how awesome 3D printing is for illustrating things. So on the website, you can there's these little embedded windows where you can, you know, move the model around and zoom in and fly around it and get a sense of what it is. Maybe not quite as good a sense as if you're holding it in your hands, but still pretty good.
Very cool. Well, thank you so much for chatting with me today.
Great. This was fun.
This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.